Golf Smarter number 295, published on August 23, 2011. Is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter.
SmarterPodcasts.com, delivering sound advice.
Top 10 Traits of Better Golfers with Jim Waldron, Part 1.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome back to the Golf Smarter podcast, Jim.
Hey, Fred. Good to be back.
It is good to have you back because we have so much fun every time you come on the show. And I know that listener reaction has always been incredibly positive to your lessons for us.
Well, thanks. It's great to be back. And I always enjoy working with you.
And last time we talked, last time you were on, we talked about the book that you're continuing to write about the 15 gates.
Which is now the 18 gates, thanks to your suggestion. Make it like a full 18 holes, a full round of golf.
I would just kind of like throw
it out there. That should have been obvious to me when I was writing it that would be a better title, right? But, yeah, and there's at least three more gates. Trust me, there's more than 18 if you really want to be nitpicky about it. But yeah, for sure, 18. That's the new title: 18 Gates of Golf and the Keys to Unlock Them. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure you can play 36 and still come up.
Easy.
But I got to believe that in the lessons that you give and in your golf schools, you have a lot of different people coming in and out of the schools that some people must just absolutely have this look on their face that they have no idea what you're talking about. They're completely baffled by what you're saying, and yet there are others who just get it immediately. And they're hearing the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's not so much the concept, the intellectual concepts, because we kind of pre-screen all our new students. Everybody's on board with the overall sort of mind-body connection approach, the sort of the Zen, sort of Eastern philosophy approach, okay. The idea that there's a subconscious mind controlling your body as opposed to conscious.
Well, yeah, there's got to be a buy-in.
That part's pretty obvious to almost everybody who comes to me.
There's got to be a buy-in before they get there. I mean, they wouldn't be signing up for school
exactly.
If they didn't buy into that. Okay.
Yeah, but what I found is, and how I kind of shifted my teaching starting about 3 years ago was, I kept asking myself, why is it some people can actually physically execute a particular aspect of the golf swing, for example, or the putting stroke, or a pitching or a chipping stroke that we're working on, and they can actually physically execute it within, literally immediately after we do a quick little, 5-minute lecture demonstration. And I mean execute it to close to a professional level of physical execution. And then the guy next to that guy can struggle with it for an hour. Maybe we'll do an hour of segment. Typically it could be anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour of devoted to each fundamental we're working on. And at the end of the hour, he's only maybe like 10% better. Hmm. All right. So some people are slow learners of physical golf skills. Other people are fast learners. And typically, the slow learners also tend to be the very high handicap players, and the fast learners tend to be people who are more in the more advanced skill level in terms of scoring. So I decided to start interviewing those two guys. I picked the worst student in the school in terms of, again, physical ability to do the swing change, and I interviewed the best student in the school, both in the school and then after they graduated, because I wanted to sort of get inside their mind in a very deep level and see if I could figure out what is it the advanced player who gets golf fairly quickly, fairly easily, doing in terms of his sort of mental approach. And when I say mental, I mean mental approach to learning how to get the body to perform better, right? Not just how to play the game in terms of course management, things like that.
I'm curious, when you're in the midst of the beginning of your teaching, is it really obvious immediately to you who's getting it and who's not?
Oh, absolutely. It's obvious within probably 30 seconds. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. You can see it in the student's body language. The person who gets it at a very deep level of their understanding, not just intellectual, what I call deep insights, the phrase I use, which is sort of the light bulb moment, and they have these traits, which we're going to talk about, I call the top 10 traits of good golfers. you can see in their body language immediately when they start doing the drill we're doing or the exercise, whatever it might be, whether it's a ball striking drill or standing in front of a mirror doing it in slow motion or using a training aid, whatever it is, you can just sort of see that they're going to do they're going to execute that aspect of the swing. Let's say it's cocking your wrist properly on the backswing, and they're going to do it either the first, somewhere between the first and the third attempt, pretty well. And the guy next to him, who's not so good, is going to struggle with it. You can just see it. And so I'm thinking to myself, everybody else is sort of in between those two extremes, right? That's the typical golf school experience. So I'm thinking to myself, if I could tap into what the bad golfer, the poor golfer is doing, the poor golf learner is doing, and tap into what the good golf, and I'm good or bad doesn't imply value, it implies, ability to execute, right? If I could figure out what that poor golfer is doing and have him do what the good golfer is doing, this is based on an NLP, a neurolinguistic patterning idea called modeling, which is if you want to be good at something, spend some time hanging out with someone who's already good, an expert at it, and model their behavior, both physical behavior and also mentally what's going on in their mind. And you'll be able to become better very quickly. That's the whole basic idea behind modeling.
Do you ever find that the people that are struggling have been playing for less time? I mean, they may be a newer golfer than the ones who kind of get it?
Sure, sometimes. But typically, most people who take our program, because we do these all-day sort of boot camp intensive golf schools that last for several days in a row, typically they're not. They're not usually not total beginners. They've been playing for a year or usually several years.
Right.
And, I'd say the average guy in that range is shooting between 90 and maybe 110, what I would call the poor golfer range who struggles. And that guy, to that guy, the game of golf is an irresistibly attractive mystery that they're trying to figure out, but they don't have a whole lot of success. They have just enough success to keep them, to have them stay in the game, but it often is very frustrating for that guy. But the other guy, the guy who gets it quickly and easily, I'll use myself as an example. I started playing at 10, 9 months later, I was shooting in the high 70s consistently in 9 months. And I know other people like that, besides myself, who got golf, usually started as a child playing early on and got to be, shooting in the 70s within a year, maybe a little less than a year, maybe a year and a half, right? Every once in a while, you run across a guy who took up golf in middle age and struggled and didn't get very much improvement the first 3 or 4 years. And all of a sudden, on his fourth or fifth year, he got serious, started doing something different, right? And a year later, he's dropped 10 or 15 strokes off his handicap, like in a year. It does happen. I know it's hard for your audience to believe that, but those guys are out there. I meet them all the time. I interview them. So that guy is a valuable resource. To get inside that person's head, you can make unbelievable improvements in your golf game once you know what sort of the rules are that person is using to guide his own game improvement process.
I've also found that when I'm on the course playing with people that are not that good, I mean, you're talking about your 90 to 110 players,
right.
They seem to know everything. It's amazing how much they know about equipment, they know about what they're doing. My favorite is what they're doing wrong. After every shot, they can tell you what they did wrong. And it's like, if you've had a lesson, no. Have you ever watched yourself take a swing? No. How in the hell do you know what you're doing wrong?
Because they don't, obviously.
They have answers. They have conversation. And it's like they talk so much about stuff. And you just want to – I feel kind of frustrated because here I am. I'm not an instructor. I'm not an instructor. But, boy, I've been interviewing them for 6 years now. So I've learned some things that now make total sense to me. And these people are like, yeah, you don't know what you're talking about. It's like, oh. Okay.
Yeah, they're playing the game I call flog. That's golf on Superman's Bizarro World. That's conscious mind golf, neurosis golf,
Yeah.
Self-delusion golf. How many ways can I deceive myself about my golf game kind of golf? Yeah. That's not real golf, by the way. But I'm talking about a different golfer than that guy.
Every Brit has their idea of what real golf is, too.
Oh, sure. Sure, of course. Yeah.
You Americans don't know what you're doing. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah. But I'm talking about golf is a little different. I'm talking about the guy who does take lessons, mm-hmm. who does, take the time to get club fitted with proper equipment, who really is a more intelligent approach, but still is frustrated with achieving the level of success he or she wants to achieve. And it's one reason we have the largest quit rate of any sport. I mean, we have less people playing golf today than we did 12 years ago in America. Asia's different. Asia's booming, which is one reason we're opening up a golf school in Asia this coming winter. But that's a whole other story. But anyhow, so I got these 10 things. Should I go through the list?
So what are the, these are the top 10 what?
These are the traits of that person. I keep using the word good. I guess I should say skilled or maybe natural. Like the natural is sort of an overused sort of marketing buzzword in golf.
Yeah, but, I wouldn't use that because that would scare me off anyway because I'm not natural.
So, there are people who can learn the physical side. I'm not talking the mental game specifically, the way that's commonly used. I'm talking about how do I get my body to behave better, more
how
like
about
a pro.
Successful? Does that successful golfers?
Successful, yeah, that would work. Yeah, top 10 traits of successful golfers.
Okay.
But I mean, I don't mean successful so much. I'm talking about the people who get it quickly and easily, the people who radically lower their score in a very short amount of time, maybe a year or two.
Okay, how about top 10 traits of better golfers?
Of better golfers. Oh, I like that. Yeah, that's good.
Okay.
Anyhow, here's what they are.
The title of today's show. Top 10 traits of better golfers. Okay.
Yeah.
Top 10 traits. So before we go further with that, Jim, let me just say that this episode of the Golf Smarter podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Now, for Golf Smarter listeners who have yet to give Audible a try, Audible would like to give you a free audiobook so that you can hear for yourself how great the experience of reading an audiobook can be. With this offer, all you need to do is go to audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter and choose any audiobook from their vast library of over 75,000 titles. And I want to make a recommendation. Since we're talking about this right now, I just did a quick search and came up with, how's this one? The Top 10 Distinctions Between Winners and Whiners by Keith Cameron Smith. And in the summary, it says, life doesn't always go according to plan, nor does golf. In fact, it's been said that life is what happens when you're making other plans. I think John Lennon said that, didn't he? We all want to be winners. And so the difference, he says, and again, this applies to golf. Winners take responsibility. Whiners play the victim. Winners find a way. Whiners find an excuse. Winners brighten a room by entering, and whiners brighten a room by leaving. Winners build friendships and whiners destroy them. So that could be your free audiobook if you like, but you can choose anything you'd like. And all you have to do to get that free audiobook is sign up today at audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter. That's audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter. All right, Jim, so now we've got the name of the show. Today, this show is going to be called The Top 10 Traits of Better Golfers. So tell me, what did you come up with? What does that mean to you?
I put a lot of time and thought into this. It's not that there's only 10. I'm sure there's way more than 10, but it's sort of like the 18-gauge thing. There's probably, like you said, there's probably 36. But these are the ones that I've sort of been, noticing in my teaching and in my interviewing of these type of players when I run across them. In fact, I played golf with a guy like this about 3 weeks ago. Here in Portland, and he was one of those guys who, typical average sort of 90 to 110 player for years, and finally he got better, he got serious, and he figured some stuff out, and now he's a plus one handicap. I mean, it's just unbelievable how much better you can really get at this game. And so, when I meet someone like that, I sit down, I talk to him, I take notes, and here's what I found out. And this is in no particular order. This is not in terms of which is the most important. This is just, I don't know how you would rate the importance of the 10. I just rate them all pretty much equally, I guess.
Okay, so then I won't do any drum rolls and go, number 10.
No, not like in David Letterman.
No, of course.
The one is what I call mental focus. I mean, people who can learn to go to a golf school or take a lesson and internalize the information the pro is giving them and actually start to see some improvement in terms of getting their body to behave better, have the ability to focus their mind where the pro asks them to focus it. And people whose mind wanders all over the place, those are the guys who struggle, trying to get better on the physical side of the game. So to learn a better golf swing, a better putting stroke, better pitching, better chipping strokes, you have to be able to focus your mind on one thing and one thing only, whatever it is that thing the pro asks you to focus on. from the beginning of your swing until the end of your swing without your mind wandering off somewhere else. And, you know, we do a whole one-day school called Rip at the Target, and that's the main thing that's taught in that school is how to focus your mind over 8 hours. So that's obviously pretty important. I mean, and not too many people are teaching how to do that skill. I mean, that's, to me, that's, you know, you got to, I start every lesson, every school with teaching people how to focus their mind. Even if it's only 5 minutes, we spend some time on it. And when I interview those poor golfers, the golfers who struggle, and ask them to focus their mind, they literally cannot do it. Their mind wanders. Within the 1.5 second duration of the golf swing, they've got their mind in at least 10 different places by the time they finish their swing.
Which means they probably have their mind in about 18 or 19 places before they when they step up to the ball.
Oh, at least, yeah.
I mean, you can just see how many people, like, they, okay, now my leg is here, I got a bit. I mean, from my perspective, what I've learned is that you better get that stuff in your head before you step up to the ball and then just clear your mind and go.
Absolutely. I'll give you an example. You know, and I'm such a stickler on this rule. Every single school I do, whether it's a standalone mental game school or a physical school dealing with the learning proper golf swing mechanics or short game or putting mechanics, I tell people, look, one of our big rules, we're going to tell you where to focus your mind. All you got to do is keep your mind there and only there. Don't focus on elsewhere. Now, that's hard to do over a golf shot if you know that. Well, Jim's, I'll give you an example. We did a school a couple months ago. We had a student who was doing pretty well. And the last day, he was struggling with his ball flight. We were doing some ball striking drills. And the focal point for that school, the segment we were working on in the golf swing mechanics, is called sideways pressure, which is one of Hogan's big swing secrets. And that means that there's a triangle, an isosceles triangle formed by your shoulder girdle at the base, your two arms are the sides. And you want to keep the two arms sort of a structural aspect to the two arms. You want the triangle to be intact, not warped throughout the swing, not bending and, you know, moving all over the place with too much arm motion. So the way you do that, which Hogan discovered, is that you press your arms toward each other with equal opposing sideways pressure. And in this case, we were focusing on the hand aspect, and all he was supposed to do was keep pressing his hands toward each other, go into what we call feel channel, one of the three primary sensory channels. The other two are visual and auditory. Auditory being where you talk to yourself, visual where you see, you know, visual images in your mind. Feel, you just feel the pressure, the sensation in the muscles, in this case the hands. And he was actually fiddling with his, you know, his address position and going to the top of the swing and stopping and looking at his hands. And I walked over. I said, "What are you doing?" He goes, "Oh, I'm working on my top of backswing position." I said, "Well, why are you doing that? You're supposed to take a full speed swing without pausing at the top and just, you know, play golf and just put your mind in your hands and see if you can keep the sideways pressure feeling." He said, "Yeah, I know, but when I do that, I may not hit it as well because I know there's something wrong with the top of my backswing position, so I'm trying to focus on that." I go, "Well, but that's not what I asked you to do. You're supposed to only put your mind in your hands and focus on that, and that will, over time, give you a better ball flight result after you've learned it." In other words, he was going back to an earlier flaw that he knew he had in his backswing from, like, you know, a day before the school, and not staying in the present moment working on this one aspect of the swing. In fact, he was trying to do both. He was trying to do the sideways pressure in his hands and focus on the top of his backswing. And what he was doing was he was basically severing his mind-body connection and just basically losing all his natural ability. And his mind was wandering all over the place. So that was an example of someone who was, you know, allowing his mind to wander, and that was the root cause beyond whatever his top of backswing issue was of his bad ball flight result. So once I got his mind back on his sideways pressure, he immediately started hitting the ball better. So
yeah, and I've had multiple debates with people on what is is the impact of the ball the main part here, or is it, you know, your follow through? Is it the full swing, or is it where the impact is? Right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's a big issue in golf. I mean, there's always been two camps about, you know, whether you should focus on impact or not. I'm kind of in the Percy Boomer, you know, the On Learning Golf book guy, that guru from back in the 30s and 40s, who said that golf is a hit the target with the ball sport, and bad golfers believe in their heart of hearts that golf is a hit the ball with the club head sport. So I always tell my golfers, if you want to increase your hit impulse, increase your flinching at impact, increase your steering or manipulation impulse, keep focusing on the ball and on impact between the ball and the club head. You'll get the full swing yips. Now, you should never focus on impact. It's like the springboard diver. When he when he, you know, leaves the board and starts flying through space down toward the surface of the water, he doesn't stop moving when he gets to the impact with the water. He keeps going down about 10 or 12 feet toward the bottom of the pool. And that's the end of the dive. And the end of the golf swing is the finish. Impact happens. This happens to occur in the middle of the forward swing. Mm-hmm. And we teach people to be present mentally, focused on one thing. Could be any number of things, although it's never going to be impact with the ball. Although we certainly want our students to observe impact. We want them to, we use the term seeing the blur. We want them to watch the club head strike the ball. You'll see a very fast blur of sort of gray-white, gray being the club head, white being the ball, which does a lot of good things for your swing, both mentally and physically. But we don't want you to be doing anything to help out physically, mentally, or emotionally during the downswing, especially during impact. Impact should be something that you let happen, not something you try to make happen. And when you surrender to the hit impulse, if you don't surrender completely, which is a form of actual blackout, but if you have some semblance of sort of semi-awareness, it's the surrender to the hit impulse thing is something you don't want to do. You might be vaguely aware of trying to help out, we call it finding the ball with the club face, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's something we do a whole one-day school in helping Cole Ripa to the target and helping people learn not to do that. So you don't want to black out, for sure. You want to be present, and you want to be observing impact, but you don't want to be doing anything to help out during impact. You know, you let it happen as opposed to make it happen.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever heard it put so succinctly on the two types of approaches, which would be hit the target with the ball or hit the ball with the club.
Yeah, I'll give Percy Boomer credit for all of that. That was his brilliant insight on his part, and it's absolutely true.
It really is.
Again, I'm not saying that from an instructional standpoint, it's not a bad thing to understand what the impact geometry or impact alignments are with both the club and the body. And I think, I know people can get results from standing in front of a mirror and posing in the proper impact position. You know, imprinting into the subconscious mind the understanding of the proper body and club position can certainly be beneficial. But in a normal speed swing, to try to do anything to help out is insane because you don't have any voluntary control. You're an automatic, both physically and mentally, whether you know it or not, during the forward swing. And you should just let those physical forces build up and sort of carry you through impact and not try to help out during impact.
Oh. Well, as it goes with the conversations that you and I generally have, we budget about 30 minutes for these conversations, and yet you wanted to talk about the top 10 traits of a better golfer, and here we are 22 minutes into our conversation.
And we're only in one.
And we're on number one. So I think we may end up doing is we're just going to make this a multiple-part conversation. And we'll continue it on. We'll actually restart the show making it a golf smarter episode, and then next episode will be golf smarter for members only.
All right.
So, let's move to number two.
Okay. Number two is that back to my three primary sensory channels, which we also every new student we train them in this. It only takes a few minutes, and I'll tell your listeners how to do the exercise. It'll be very specific, very concrete. You need a partner. So let's say it's me and you, Jim and Fred, and I'm the teacher and Fred's the student. I would walk up to Fred and say, Fred, do you mind if I put my hand on your shoulder? Fred, you're going to say yes, right?
Yes.
Okay. So I put my hand on your shoulder, and I'll say, Fred.
Oh, wait. When you say, do I mind, I'm supposed to say yes? No, I don't mind. Go ahead.
No, you don't mind. Correct.
Yes, get your hands off of me.
This is like Bob and Ray for golf, you know. For those of you older people who recognize Bob and Ray's radio show,
I do.
Or even worse, who's on first? You know, Abbott and Costello.
Right.
One of the all-time great comedy bits, by the way. But there's three primary sensory channels. In this exercise, we teach you what they are and how to recognize them, how to shift from one channel to the next. Because once you can do that, that helps you with the whole mental focus thing, right? So I'll have you turn your head and look at my hand, literally turn your head and look. That's your external visual channel. Mm-hmm. I'll have you turn your head back, face forward, close your eyes. I'll say, Fred, picture my hand on your shoulder. When you can see my hand, a picture in your mind of my hand on your shoulder, you're going to nod your head so I know you're there. And that's called the internal visual channel, right, imagination.
Quick question here. I'm a right-handed golfer. Are you putting your hand on my right or left shoulder?
Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. Okay, because right now it's on my right shoulder. Go ahead, my eyes are
closed. Doesn't matter. Then I'll say, Fred, say the following phrase out loud. Jim's hand is touching my shoulder. And so you'll
Jim's
say that, right?
Jim's hand is touching my shoulder.
Okay, that's your external auditory channel, mm-hmm. right? So there's an external and internal component of each of these. Then I'll say it to yourself in your mind. And when you hear your own voice, repeat the phrase in your head. Then you're going to nod your head so I know you're there. That's your internal auditory or your verbal or your voice channel, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you talk to yourself over a golf shot, that's the internal auditory channel. Then I'll squeeze my hand, I'll kind of pulse my hand on your shoulder so you can feel the pressure, my squeezing. And I'll say, feel my hand on your shoulder without talking about it, without saying that sentence in your head, and without seeing a picture, pure sensation. And when you're in that space, that mental space, that's called the feel or kinesthetic channel. And you'll nod your head when you're there. That's the first part of the drill. The second part of the drill is I'm going to say the word voice for you to go into the auditory channel, picture for you to go into the visual channel, or feel for you to go into the feel channel. And you're to follow my directions and go into that channel as quickly as you can. When you get there, you nod your head so I know you're there. And so I'll say picture, and usually about, you know, 2 or 3 seconds later, sometimes a little longer, the person will nod their head, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then I'll say voice, same thing. It might be 5 seconds, it might be 1 second, somewhere in there. It's the person will access the auditory channel. They'll hear themselves say, Jim's hand's touching my shoulder. They'll nod their head so I know. Then I'll say feel. And I just do that for a couple of minutes. I'll go back and forth, feel, picture, voice. So the student clearly understands that those are the three primary sensory channels that his conscious mind awareness sort of hangs out in throughout the day. Although from a focal point standpoint, which is narrow focus of the mind, like looking at a dot in the center of the circle, that's your focal point, kind of like focal point vision, you know?
Mm-hmm.
From a focal point standpoint, you can only be in one of those three primary channels at any given moment in time. You can't be in all of them at the same time. You can't even be in two of them at the same time. You can only be in one. And, you know, one of the things we tell people about learning golf effectively and also practicing golf once they leave us and go out on their own, you have to know which of those three primary sensory channels you should be focusing your mind in when you're practicing or when you're learning. Because it could be the wrong one. It could be like if I was a general contractor and you were my new carpenter's helper and I said, here, take this hammer and go saw those two by fours.
What?
Well, you might be able to break the board with a 2x4, but it's not going to be a precise cut like it would be with a saw. In other words, certain aspects of learning the golf swing mechanics, for example, require you to be in one of those three channels and not in the other two. So, for example, if I said in the early stages of learning the swing plane fundamentals, which is the swing shape or swing geometry, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which of those three channels should you be in? What would you say?
Visualize.
Exactly. You'd be in visual. Because
woo-hoo!
By its very nature, geometry is a visual kind of medium. Visual. The content of geometry is visual. It's picturing planes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Angles and planes. So, yeah, you'd be in visual. If I said to you, I want you to rotate your shoulders on the backswing, your shoulder girdle to be more precise, to maximum range of motion on this next swing, which one would you want to be in?
Feel.
Feel. If I said, I want you to show me a good tempo to a 1-1 rhythm or a 1-2 rhythm, which one would you want to be in?
Visual?
No, auditory.
Auditory? Yeah. The 1-2 part.
Because rhythm or tempo, by the very nature, has to do with timing. So you would hear your voice say 1 in the backswing and 1, or you could say the word 2 on the forward swing.
Okay.
Right? So by the very nature of tempo and rhythm, it's auditory.
Yes.
Rhythm being like musical, right?
Sure, by of course.
Yeah.
My bad.
Yeah.
Okay, so I get
you can also feel tempo and rhythm, too, because it could be feel. But for most people, your internal auditory channel is where you'd be when you're practicing rhythm and tempo. But you would not believe how many people, and I'll demonstrate all this when we do rhythm and tempo in our schools, and I'll check with them 5 minutes later when they're hitting balls, and I'll say, okay, are you focusing on the 1-1 drill? Oh, yeah. Are you hearing yourself say 1 in the backswing and 1 in the forward swing, and they'll nod their head? But I can sort of tell by watching their swing and their body language that they're not really getting it. I go, are you sure you're hearing a voice in your head say 1 in the backswing? Well, not really. I go, well, where's your mind? Well, I'm picturing the word 1, and I'm mm-hmm. picturing the word 1.
Mm-hmm.
I go, well, so you're in visual channel. Oh, the person goes, oh, of course, yes, I'm in visual channel. I thought I was in auditory, but I was really back to my dominant channel because everybody has one of those three that they're dominant in, that they kind of hang out in during their waking hours, right?
Right.
So the trick is to know which of those three primary channels, and I usually tell people, I say, look, I want you to feel this, meaning infield channel, or I want you to picture this in visual channel, just to kind of remind them. But the second trait that we're talking about here is the feel channel. The distinguishing, one of the 10 distinguishing things of these better golfers who get golf physical skills quickly and easily is they have the ability to feel both their body motion and their club motion. And they feel their club motion through their hands. You can't know what the club motion is doing literally directly because it's not part of your nervous system. It's an object you hold. But you can know indirectly what the club face angle is doing throughout the swing, where the club head is throughout the swing, what angle of attack it's approaching ground level through impact. There's various, you know, you can feel the weight of the club in your fingers throughout the swing. So you can train yourself to feel what the club's doing when you train your hands to be very sensitive and aware through feel. And you can train the rest of your body to be aware of what the body mechanical system is doing simply by putting your mind in certain body parts while you swing in feel. But again, when we first teach people to do this, when we check them a few minutes later, the average golfer is not in feel. They forget that it's supposed to be. They literally forget the instruction from 2 minutes prior. I'm not making this up. This is the norm. And they go into they either go into visual or they go into auditory. And they, if I say, for example, focus on your right shoulder from field channel, and I check with them for feedback, probably 75% of my students, when they're first doing this drill, will either be picturing themselves, they'll picture the right shoulder like a movie, right? Or they'll say the word in their head, right shoulder, right shoulder, right shoulder. And, of course, when you're doing either of those two things, you're not feeling it.
Right.
Understand?
Yeah.
Of the three channels, the only one that has the possibility of you being in touch with objective reality is feel. The other two, by their very nature, are symbolic, or therefore abstract. Therefore, you could be picturing your right shoulder doing X or Y or Z, and you could actually be doing something completely, in fact, the polar opposite of what you're picturing, and not know it because you're stuck with you're looking at a fantasy image of what a right shoulder is, as opposed to the objective reality of what your body's actually doing.
Interesting. I don't know if this is relevant to this at all, but maybe I'm just wanting to tell the story. So I was playing recently and with my son, who's just now starting to get interested in playing golf, my younger one. And there was a par three. It was a long par three, and I was the only one who put the ball on the green, except I put my ball on the front right of the green, and it was a long green with the flag in the back left. Okay. And so I stood behind the flag looking down the and it was an uphill putt, looking down towards my ball, kind of got an idea of the break, and I saw about a 12 to 15 inch break coming from my ball, you know, left to right. And then I walked out, which I generally do. I walk from the pin to my ball, counting my steps, and then I'm like, okay, 18 steps, right. So then I stood over my ball and I looked up at the pin and I saw, you know, I got the direction and I went 65 feet. And I verbalized it, you know, it's like, okay, 65 feet. And my son like rolled his eyes like, what are you doing? Shut up. You know, I mean, as he does when I do most things, he's like, what are you doing? And, but he chose not to say anything and he just watched the ball roll. His jaw got deeper, longer, until the ball fell in the cup.
Cool.
And I felt great for two reasons. One, I got to do that in front of my kid. That was awesome. But then a guy on a green who was like on a different green, like 30 yards away, yelled, "Nice putt!" He screamed. And I'm like, I go, "Give me your hat, quick, so I can tip my hat," right? But did that announcing the 65 feet part, did that help me in any way, or is that just like, wow, that was just a lucky putt. But
I mean, there's, you know, you could have trained yourself if you have a putting distance control method. In fact, I got an email from a student from Singapore about this the other day, who's a computer engineer, came with this really complicated method, very analytical engineering-type method for distance control and putting. Sounds like your method where you literally walk off the distance. He called it a putting distance control algorithm. It's kind of like Spock, right? Mm-hmm. Mr. Spock in Star Trek. But he putts real well with that. But, you know, he determines ahead of time how long a backstroke, how long a through stroke, literally measured in inches, but he has to practice with a yardstick on the putting surface to know, take it back 10 inches and through 10 inches, or take it back 16 inches and through 16 inches.
Yeah, see, for me, it's all feel. Yeah, for me, it's feel. It's like, okay, if I have a putt that's 9 feet versus a putt that's 20 feet, I know that the feel of it's going to be different.
Yeah.
But I have to tell myself, this is a 9 foot putt, this is a 20 foot putt, this is a 65 foot putt.
So what that does is that's called a strategy. What we know is that good players do a strategy, and it usually ends with feel, not always, but usually they'll end with feel. But it might start with visual, like picturing the ball rolling.
Mm-hmm.
Then you might say to yourself, I know I can make this putt. You might say that sentence, or in this case, it's 65 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll have a feel in your hands for the proper length of stroke and speed of stroke. You know, and this is another aspect, which is actually number three, which we're going to segue into here in a minute.
No,
which
we're not.
Is what I call awareness of awareness.
No, we're not. Good tease, but no, we're not.
No, we're not. Okay, we're not going to segue into it. But that is something that good players do. They have what I call a shot execution strategy that they've learned from spending a lot of time in the range hitting balls on the putting green. They know that when they go through a certain strategy, you know, visual first, for example, then auditory, and then when they execute, they're in feel mode. Again, most commonly, I'm not saying it's not possible to execute in visual. In fact, it's also very common to go into visual and picture the target and let that be your focal point during the swing, right?
Sure.
But the point is, they come up with a way. For example, people who are target oriented in the visual channel, they might start out by saying, "I'm a great putter," to access confidence. They might say that phrase to themselves, right? Like a positive affirmation. That takes a tenth of a second to say that in your mind, maybe, or half a second, whatever it is. And then they might feel in their hands a feeling of warmth and a kind of a nice, warm kind of energy feeling in their hands. And then during the actual stroke, they might be picturing an internal visual channel, the target. But the point is, good players sort of figure out through trial and error what these effective strategies are.
Hmm.
You know, we call them shot-making strategies, right?
Yeah. Well, I know that there's times that I've been lining up a putt, and I'll hear myself say, "I got this one." I mean, that, like, I see a path from my ball to the hole, and there's times that it goes in, and it almost felt like it was an unconscious act of, "I knew I had this one." And then there were other times where I'm trying to convince myself, "I need to make this, so I'm going to tell myself I've got this one," and I miss it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Or I'm just trying to justify it later on.
Yeah, that's a big purpose of practice is what I call the creative tinkering part of practice, is to figure out what these effective strategies are, and even more importantly, figure out what your bad strategies are so you don't use them on the golf course.
Mm.
I mean, you know what I mean? I mean, it's very common for people to, almost everybody has a strategy of some sort every time they hit a golf ball. Usually, for a high handicap golfer, though, it's sort of like their subconscious mind contributes maybe 50% of the strategy, and their conscious mind contributes the other 50%, and it's pretty much at random. So every shot's a little different in terms of a strategy, and therefore they're inconsistent in terms of the results because their strategy is inconsistent. But the good player, they have a very focused, disciplined mind. They've taught themselves through experience, through trial and error. They've proven to themselves, if I do this visual first, then auditory, then kinesthetic, VAK, to use NLP terminology, I'll increase my odds of hitting a good shot.
A-OK.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, I know we teased number three, but we're going to have to tease it for another episode, and we'll do a golf for members only episode. On the one hand, I hate to tease people with that, but on the other hand, I love to do that. Guys, if you want to be a Golf Smarter member, please just go to golfsmarter.com and sign up today. It's only $15, and you will have access to the entire archives of Golf Smarter that's lasted 6 years every single week except for two. And you can hear conversations like this and go back through our archives and listen to all the other conversations that Jim and I have had that have been incredibly helpful for me. And I know from feedback that a lot of other Golf Smarter listeners have gotten a lot from what Jim has had to say. So, Jim, can we do this again real soon?
Absolutely. Love to.
Up next, for members only, Jim Waldron returns for 7 more traits of better golfers. Are you one of them? If not, you'll need to listen and learn. And now we've got the winning combination. Combine Jim's 10 traits and Tony Manzoni's book, The Lost Fundamental, One Simple Move, Better Golf Forever, and you're ready for some serious competition. Pick it up now only in the Golfer's Mart at golfsmarter.com.
Smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.